Welcome. My name is John Beck, and I co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, which is going into its 20th year in its lecture series starting next fall, and is actually about in its 23rd year of doing exhibits, film openings, concerts, poetry and fiction readings, various other kinds of programming. Come on in, Jim. We got some spots up here for you. And we are very happy with the ongoing collaboration between the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations, Labor Education Program, and the MSU Museum, the Traditional Arts Program, that has really been the basis of Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. This is our first nighttime lecture, so it's kind of fun that we have such a packed house for it. Now, there are sign-in sheets. There are white sign-in sheets. We would love it if you signed in. But I'm going to make a few announcements and then introduce our wonderful, wonderful guest tonight, Philip Ritterman. So next Monday, in our Brown Bag series, Laurie Summers is going to be talking about songs of miners, lumberjacks, and schooner men, Alan Lomax's Michigan Legacy. And we have an exhibit opening that goes along with that talk, so I'll just hand those. Bobby, you get to be my sergeant at arms over there. Then, on the 19th of March, after spring break, now, we did this on purpose. The title is Love, Sex, and Greed, Reflecting Gender and Class in French Comic Opera. We decided to really, you know, do the whole 50 Shades of Grey in advance. So we had this set up last year. So Marcy Ray from the College of Music is going to be doing that talk. We commend it to you. Then on the 27th of March, Rebecca Munich from Ann Arbor is coming up from the Ecology Center to talk about labor, livelihoods, and Brazilian black gold, navigating fair trade, coffee quality, and environmental standards. I'll send that around. And last but not least, we had to cancel because of the snowstorm in early February, Maria Katera's talk, who's coming up from American Studies and Women's Studies at University of Michigan. So it's been rescheduled for March 30th, and she's talking about Working for Justice, Legacies of Latina Activism in Southeastern Michigan. So I'll send that around. And last but not least, if you look at the bottom of what's coming around, our last two talks in April are listed there. I commend those to you. I'm going to introduce Philip in 1 minute, but I'm going to close this door and turn off that light so that it's not in our way. Okay, tonight's talk, the title of tonight's talk is Emperor's River, Photographing Along China's Grand Canal. And the exhibit downstairs is co-curated by two wonderful people. And where are they?
Howard's
over here. Shirley's back. There. We are so lucky to have wonderful, wonderful curators here. Some of them are adjuncts, some are on staff. And the show downstairs is part of a year-long exploration of China that's being done here on campus. And if you have not seen the exhibit yet, I think it's absolutely stunning. And Philip's huge photographs are rich in color, rich in detail, and everything else. Now, here tonight, we're going to hear about his work photographing that. That itself is a piece of work, to say the least. But many of the images are images of people working along the river as well. So we'll hear about all of that and see them in a moment. So Philip Ritterman, let me just read this because the fact that that will help me not fall all over it. Temporal and spatial themes lie at the heart of Ritterman's photographic explorations. From nocturnal scenes of industry, do come in, to pristine landscape, his images span opposite ends of our environment. Born and raised in Lima, Peru, Ritterman lived in Germany and Spain before immigrating to the United States in the early 1980s. His work is held in over 100 public, corporate, and private collections, from MoMA, New York, to the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, France. He exhibits in national and international venues and was honored with a mid-career survey at the Museum of Photographic Arts in San Diego, which published the monograph Navigating by Light. Ritterman has been teaching photography for over 30 years in the USA and abroad. In 2011, the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego exhibited large-scale images from Emperor's River, photographic project conducted in China. And we have a number of those down right now in the main gallery. So do sign in on those white sheets. I welcome you to tonight's lecture. And please join me in welcoming Philip Ritterman to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Thank you, John. Is this okay? Everybody can hear? All right. And Howard, also for putting this together. I actually really enjoyed walking through the show yesterday. I'm particularly fond of group shows because there's just so much more to see and more different perspectives on a theme. I think there's that enriches the experience for anybody who goes to see the show. And I understand you've got programming throughout the year for it, so I think that's a pretty good immersion into, I think, one of the most important subjects unfolding right now. So what I'd like to do is start off with a quick view of how I got to go to the China project, which is the end of heavy industry in Europe that I was photographing a little bit, not as consciously, perhaps, as I did when I went to China, but it was what it was part of the subject matter that interested me as I was photographing at night, getting my feet wet in photography in the early 80s. All of that industry didn't just suddenly disappear because we figured out how to make things cleanly and sustainably. We just shut it down here and shoved it all over to the other side of the world to set up shop in a cheaper production environment with lax environmental regulations and labor laws. So I'll just go ahead and start this rolling. I mean, is this okay light-wise, or do we need to dim any more, or can everybody see all right? You'll see some of this stuff in the work on China as well, and it's, you know, coal-fired power plants, which I encountered when I was in China every 40 to 60 miles along the Grand Canal, which is heavily urbanized, heavily industrialized section of the country. Who here is familiar with Barrington Hillebecker's topology of coal mining towers and all of that stuff? Anyone? A few hands? Okay. Anyway, like I said, that all of that was disappearing out of the European landscape. To me, it just seemed like a fantastic time to be photographing at night, because living in Germany in the winters in northern Germany, it was much like the weather here, not today, but you know, I understand that you have dark, long winters, and at night there's all this amazing light that, you know, pours out of buildings, and I was into film noir and had just sort of discovered all these old movies like The Third Man for myself, and that really just kind of captured my attention visually. I'd been working as a pharmaceutical rep, a job which I totally despised doing, but the money was really great, and it afforded me travel and the medium to, you know, to get around to photograph and in my spare time, while avoiding work and home life as much as possible, I would be out photographing at night. So it became a very long exploration. You've noticed the images have already transitioned out of Europe. But industry kept interesting me. And underneath it were these currents of figuring out how a camera can show me the passage of time in a way that I can't possibly experience it. Many of these exposures are 20 minutes, 30 minutes, to hours long. Was working with film that was fairly slow. The cameras were slow. The apertures were small. And instead of fighting it, I eventually embraced it into thinking, well, this is really interesting to see what happens to the world when you look at it and give it a really long glance. You know, and everything that moves leaves a trace of some sort. And that's not how I can see it, but that's a pretty good reason to photograph, right? It can show me stuff that I can't see. So that's kind of what got me rolling on this exploration, which ended up being a 10-year exploration. Here then I'm in San Diego already, spelunking around the waterfront, junkyards, and that sort of thing. I actually went on a first date with my now ex-wife. Maybe that was part of it, but it was ill-fated. So here I'm photographing the Exxon Valdez under construction, and no idea that it was going to be infamous, you know. But one of the things I was telling some of the students today is that as you embark on this photographic journey, could be a lifetime, make sure you retain the rights to your images. If you opt for a cushier job with Getty Images or something like that, know that the paycheck is in exchange for the rights to your images in perpetuity. So depending on how concerned you are about something or how important a subject is to you, you really want to make sure that you retain, you know, control of imagery. So the National Steel and Shipbuilding Company in San Diego was where the Exxon Valdez was built and then also repaired after it ran aground. So they trundled it all the way back down the coast, leaking oil all the way, to put a patch on it and fresh paint and a new name and send it back out. But let me go ahead and move this along a bit quicker. I mean, as I understand it, the history here with the mining operations north of here, there would be some affinity to this kind of, and I see it in the mural back there. I mean, this is the story that happens in all industrialized nations, you know, the story that I was following in China, too. One of the things that really began to interest me was, so I'm into year 6, 7, 8 of this nighttime exploration, and figuring out how to get the camera onto a moving platform so that the world is now revolving around the camera instead of just some lights being moved through the frame. Images like this haunt me for years before I finally figure out how to get them done. They're just ideas that show up that, you know, you might stumble across something in one image that leads you onto the next thing, which then leads to the next thing, and so on. This was a counterpoint to the work I was doing while I was in the shipyards, just kind of scribbling around with light at night, just goofing around mostly. Also shows you why I didn't go in and become an art major and a painter. So, but interestingly, here's this, what we're used to in our experience as just being alive is that we are always present. We may be absent-minded, but we are always in the present. We can't, in our mind's eye, compile images from the last 5 minutes and look at the relationships of things that were different in the room during that time. And with photography, you can do this. Because I'm running around inside that picture while the shutter is open, drawing with a flashlight that's pointed back at the camera. And I can't see what I'm doing. Nobody else can see what I'm doing. All they see is a maniac with a flashlight. And then this shows up in the film, right? So all of that stuff is pretty juicy to me and pretty interesting. This was a defunct football program, so I thought I'd kind of riff on that. I don't think they were too pleased about it, though. That was an attempt at commentary about overcrowding prison populations and this prison industry that seemed more robust in this country than anywhere else in the world. So to me, the building had an abstracted feel of the Star-Spangled Banner and then, you know, this shooting gallery arrangement down below it. All of it done with one exposure in camera, running around in front of the camera with lights, grabbing a student, putting them up, you know, drawing light behind them to create the silhouette, and then running towards the camera with a blinking light. There were many other attempts that didn't work out quite as well. So when that sort of ran dry, please come in. There's a few more seats here. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, if you'd like. So I'm living in the western United States in San Diego on the coast. It's the land of F-64, large format, black and white, you know, Ansel Adams, Weston, Win Bullock, and that whole tribe. And I'm thinking, well, I've got to deal with landscape in some way. What led me to photographing landscape became more about that I had a sense of urgency about what we were doing to the landscape in Southern California during a booming housing expansion. I mean, hills were being flattened, valleys filled in, and 1,000 units of sort of cookie-cutter stucco houses were being placed down at a go. And I thought, well, how do I talk about landscape in a way that's going to impart any sort of sense of urgency? And I made, I think, pretty pictures for a long time, but I think I failed at imparting that sort of sense of urgency about the landscape. I mean, I like them, I live with some of them, but they don't, it's not a call to action, right? It's just a pretty picture. And so as much as I like and support and contribute to the Sierra Club and other foundations, when I get the annual calendar that shows me all these pristine, full color, gorgeous natural vistas, I think that could actually lull you into a false sense of thinking, well, heck, it's fine. If you can shoot it, it's still there, so why should I care? The flip side would be to photograph dying sea life, oil slicks on the ocean, you know, belching smokestacks, and then send that out as a calendar for you to stare at all year. It's like, oh, great, you know, here's the disaster for April. I'm going to live with this for a month. I mean, that's not going to go over very well either. So it really begs the question, like, how do you talk about something important? How do you make images about it? How do you present it to get a discussion going? I'm just kind of hurrying this on a little bit. I tried to make them more ominous and any number of other things, but then people thought that was a little too creepy and they didn't want to live with it. So I thought they were nice. I mean, I thought they were just fine. Anyway, so eventually I saw my way clear to juxtaposing images, forcing them together, forcing a narrative. And it really started with this image, which was so anthropomorphic. People see a dancer or a snake or any number of things in there. And when paired with something else, then all of a sudden there was a tension there that I could do something with, right? I could start a discussion. And there's a chair up here, Therese, right up there. And I think this was really the beginning of figuring out how to get photographs to actually work on a level that was intentional right from the get-go versus just a happen chance that the image does something, causes an emotion or something, but it's more of a lucky accident. So playing off of what we inherit and what we leave behind and doing it in a visual way so there'd be some kind of correspondence. And also very freeing to put together places that are geographically completely unrelated, just to make a point. And this I'm going to also hurry through. Because I'd like to linger on the China work more. I have to show you just a couple of these, just because it's a bizarre folly. This is a place in Mexico called Gilitla, and it's a fantasy park that a crazy Brit with too much money built on 80 acres of jungle in the mountains. It's like he changed the course of the river to build this stuff. Staircases to nowhere, you know. You'd easily fall to your death on any one of numerous occasions there. But anyway, okay, so here we go with Emperor's River. 2008, 2009, speaking about work, my work had completely dried up. There were no jobs, no commercial jobs that I was able to get. Print sales had long since evaporated. I was teaching at San Diego State and had been offered a third class, so I thought, well, at least I've got that gig going. And then a week after they said that I had an extra class to teach, they told me I didn't have any classes to teach. And there was a big round of budget cuts, and all the adjunct lecturers were relieved of their responsibilities. What I did have was a ticket to go to China to participate in an exhibition and a photography conference. It was the only thing left to do. I mean, there was really nothing for me to do here except for maybe pull my belt tighter and try to hunker down and make it through. My wife was also self-employed and in the construction business, and so that was flat on its back with the housing bubble having gone kaput. So I cooked up a project to go to China and photograph along the Grand Canal, which you may now, however many people have seen the show already or maybe read about it a little bit, but it's 1,000 miles long. It was begun in 460 BC. It was built by hand, all free labor, because, you know, the emperor commanded whomever to build it. And in several phases, eventually was punched through all the way from Beijing to south of Shanghai to Hangzhou. It's a cultural dynamo and an economic engine for China, and has been ever since, and would probably rate as importantly, or if not more so, than the Great Wall, which really was just a barrier to keep Mongols out. But this thing was production, it was strategic, it was a way to transport troops and grain and goods, and, you know, commerce blossomed. What I thought I would find was a lot of the imagery, like that first image with the stone bridge, and that turned out to be less and less the case. And instead what I found was a lot of construction and a wholesale remaking of the cultural landscape. There were quite a few places where you could see the displacement and where a lot of people were forced into just living on barges. Meanwhile, there are these glass and steel towers going up. So there's, not unlike in the mural behind you, the story that is happening in China right now is the same story that all industrialized nations have suffered through. You know, those same convolutions that everybody goes through, or convulsions. The environment, culture, history, people are all sort of, you know, you run roughshod over them in this dash towards progress and prosperity, right? And it's no different there. What is different, in my view, is just the scale and the speed at which all of this is happening. Because it's also an information revolution as well as an industrial revolution all sort of rolled into one, because there's a lot of catching up to do. This image is downstairs, and I encourage you to go up to it and get your noses right up on the plexiglass, just a quarter of an inch away from it. But there are details in these images that it's why I work this way. I'd like you, and okay, and now I'm pointing at it and saying, go and look at this, but I'd prefer it if you went and discovered it for yourself, okay? Instead of me going to China and, without a proper understanding of the country, pointing my lens at certain things and saying, this is important, and this is important, and I think you should look at this, I'd rather bring back a really wide canvas that you can find out everything that's there. What's a contradiction? What works? How does it work? So back over here, there's a guy living on this barge. And to me, it's one of the most heartbreaking images in there, because the guy in the cormorant fisher, I'm assuming most of you know what this is. It's a thousands of year old tradition of fishing with the help of birds. And they're tethered, they have a noose that allows them to swallow smallish fish, but not the big ones, and they have to hand them over. But look where he's trying to do this. You know, this is heavily polluted water. And in the print, you can see his bony back. You know, I mean, he's an old guy, and he's still trying to make the go of it. Meanwhile, those mountains of coal in the back, those are piled high on barges. Coal is burned at the most advanced rate ever. I mean, China now burns more coal than the entire rest of the world put together, even though their coal reserves, you know, can't handle that for a long time. But, I mean, one of the underlying sort of tenets for this project was to try to put a face on the statistics that we all hear and read and you know, see on TV. It's almost daily news on growth figures, trade surpluses, trade imbalances, pollution numbers, expansion numbers, you know, gross national product, how long this expansion has been going on in China. It's in its 30th year, I think, and it just keeps going, slowing down now, but still growing at 7%, which we would, you know, be gaga over. But to keep it moving forward, it has to keep growing this way, you know. And so there's a real change, I think, in the wind about how to sustain this without first running out of environment, really, because you're producing all the goods for the entire rest of the world right there. And we're driving this, every one of us in this room, you know. I mentioned earlier in the class, if I were to snap my fingers and magically make everything made in China disappear out of the room, what would be left? The projector would be gone, laptops would be gone, cell phones, sneakers, a lot of clothing, maybe the tables, not sure, maybe the drywall. There's a lot of stuff that wouldn't be here, you know. So we are so tied into this whole phenomenon. Not just the US's consumer appetite, but the entire rest of the developed world consumes Chinese goods. And so we drive how things are changing there, in the environment, in the society, and in the entire landscape. So here's some labor conditions you probably wouldn't be too fond of, but the fact is they're working incredibly well with basic tools, no protective gear at all. The woman in the background, I don't know if you can see that, is kicking along empty acetylene gas cylinders, rolling them over 480 volts of current coming from that panel over there, in loafers. He's cutting without eye protection, but you know, they're working, and to a person that I encountered working in heavy kind of industrial settings like this, they were happily working. I mean, industrious as hell. Also, what they were doing here was cutting out a corner that had been smashed in, that's it right there, and replacing it. It's much easier to build a barge from scratch than to fit something into a compound shape like that. And I saw them build it. I was there for about an hour, and with a tape measure and a little, well, okay, that's good, spot weld, bang, 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 here goes another piece, and it was just taking shape right in front of my eyes. So incredible craftsmen. And whenever there was a break, they would, you know, come over and want to see what was on the back of the camera. So even though I got stared at a lot and I couldn't really hide very well, they were quite happy to just let me roam around and photograph and do as I pleased. Boss man on the left. And you know, you can always tell who's in charge or who owns the business. Boss woman on the right. Well, you'll see the photograph downstairs, so I'll let you discover what there is to discover there. Howard asked me a couple of times to sort of talk a bit about how the images are put together, I'm not going to nerd out on you technically, okay? But all of these images from China are made up out of multiple views. They're not a single image. While I was working with one exposure at night over a long period of time in the past, these are made by putting together multiple images. In this case, could be 30 or 40. There's a lot going on here. The barge is moving, the crane is moving, the trucks are coming and going, people are moving around, the angles of the boat are shifting, and so I just had to keep rotating my camera around and kind of capturing this view in segments, large overlapping segments, until I had all this material together from which I could then craft an image. And everything is where it was, but not all of this was all here at the same time. And it kind of goes to this whole notion of how photographs and memory are really so different. And a memory is a layered thing. A memory is not an instant that is last Tuesday at 9 o'clock in the morning. There was one perfect 125th of a second. That's not a memory. That's just a snapshot. These images, to me, after coming back from these places where I've now spent some time and I've observed and I can put together something that actually reflects a bit more of what it was like for me to be there, those I feel are more complete, more immersive, more something. But of course they'd be tossed out of any kind of journalistic endeavor, right? Because they just don't fit the bill of an authentic, true, pure photographic moment. I think that's worth a discussion. Here we're stocking up to bring some food along because the guy who was working with me, my fixer, he had organized that we could get onto a barge. And they weren't about to accept payment, so we thought, well, we'll bring gifts. You know, we'll bring some food. And so he was just buying some food from the local floating supermarket. And we spent several days on the barge, witnessed going through these locks where you have to get in line, get a number, and get your paperwork through and pay fees. The life of the barge captains, the families that run these barges, it's like a whole culture on its own. They come largely from one town, the name of which it escapes me at the moment. But financing for the barges is all private or through, you know, not official bank loans. And at one place, this private money lender showed up, and he was directly from Central Casting. I swear to God, he was chain smoking, he had two cell phones, a loud Hawaiian shirt, and he was yelling at them that he wanted his money now, and he had two thugs with him. I mean, unbelievable. And it was just, well, the rules changed and I want my money now, you know? So one of the guys had to get off and take his little moped and get to the next train station and get home and rustle up some money, you know? And they were just mortified by this whole thing. That's a money tree for good luck out there. It always came out in the mornings and got put on the bow. But the barges don't have any kind of sentimental names. There's just usually a number, and it's a working environment. These are the two families, and the guy who was supervising the load, making sure that nobody stole any coal. He was a beautiful guy. We couldn't talk at all. But we sat there. You know, he's the guy who's in the previous image right there and in this one. He was just always in the front of the boat making sure that everything was up to snuff. So this is also widespread. I'm sure you've seen photographs of this, but you know, whole city areas, 20 blocks at a time, just flattened, and people relocated into different housing. You can see a glimpse of it in the background there. Of course, this creates all sorts of upheaval. I mean, even if the conditions for people to that they move into are better, the physical conditions of the place are better, they lose all their connection to that place, their neighbors, and everything else. And I'm afraid that all those vertical silos that are being built everywhere are going to create the kinds of problems that we all had here with the projects, right? Low-income housing projects. And it didn't go so well, not here, not in England, where they built them after the war, where they were in need of cheap housing. And it didn't go well anywhere. And I don't see how it can go well here either. On top of that, you have now a population of about 120 million people. That's the working migrant population in that leaves the towns, goes to the factories, lives at the factory, works there all year, and goes home for a week over New Year's, which was just last week. So you have this massive migration of 120 million plus people moving across the country to get home for a week, to get back, to go to work, so they can send money home. This is a high-speed rail line from Beijing to Shanghai, which was still under construction when I was there, and it was then announced that it was finished a year ahead of schedule. This is, you know, a great PR stunt to show how capable this industry now is, right? How this economy can pump out high-tech stuff like this. And it wasn't like they were just building it in one spot and moving it forward slowly. There were 50 spots along the way where they were building in both directions, so that joined up really fast. We can't even get it together to build a high-speed rail to decide to build one, and every time we decide to do it and we look at the budget, it costs 10 times more than it did the last time we discussed it. But it's this mad dash to modernity, and you know, everything that gets run over in that process that was really sort of most evident everywhere. This is completely surrounded by high-rises, and this is a 93-year-old man at the time who we got talking to, and he said, yeah, you know, we went into the space and it was dark and damp and not comfortable, and they had relocation money, but nobody would take them. Because nobody who just bought and invested in brand new apartments wanted to have them live there and then die in there. So they had nowhere to go. This is just one little story, you know? And this is the kind of stuff that happens when there's economic expansion on this scale. It's just gonna happen. This is an image that isn't in the show. It's 10 feet long. And again, you know, detail that really kind of, there's some people who work in the construction site who've sort of taken up residence temporarily in the new apartments there. And I'm standing in a building just like this, and there's another whole group of buildings like it behind me. And as far as I can see, there's just building going on. This is in the city of Wuxi. Yeah. And the need for housing is there because they predict, you know, there's going to be hundreds of millions of people moving into the cities. So now I keep reading about this stuff, and the middle class in China is somewhere in between 150 to 250 million people. It's not quite sure what the numbers are there. I see conflicting numbers there. But our entire population in this country is 350 million about, right? There's still another billion people that they want to lift into the middle class. And this is what the expansion looks like already with just this group of 200 or so million people who have made it into the middle class. Then there's, of course, India and Africa also on the rise, also doing this. So whatever happens in this whole part of the world over the next couple decades, I mean, it will completely define all of our lives, right? Because we have to figure some serious stuff out. You know, energy production and pollution on a scale that has to really move the needle, because I don't think we can sustain it. And it's not up to us to tell them, okay, well, we industrialized and we wrecked our environment and we sort of rehabilitated it to some extent and we've got cleaner cars now, but no, you can't do this. It's like, who are we to say this, right? So it's a really complicated equation, and everything we buy drives what happens there. So I keep wanting to tie that circle. I mean, there are hyper-modern areas that are just, to me, this speaks of great ambition. You know, it's a shout out to the world. Like, this is like Brasilia or something like that, right? Some people think this is a completely computer-generated image that is not real when they look at it. And I agree. I mean, it looks unreal. This is the southern entrance to the canal, so it's very inauspicious. And actually, I was trying to get there multiple times and kept being taken other places. This was one of them, because this was a lot more presentable. So it was just a communication flaw. The more prosperous cities along the way, along the canal, 21 of them, have these heritage parks that run right through the middle of the town that speak to the history of the canal. And I don't know if we have something like this in the States, but when people would ask what I was doing, and we would say, well, I'm photographing the Grand Canal, and they'd say, huh, oh, that old thing. Like, it was no big deal, because to them, it's just always been there, right? And it's a huge deal, man. This is the largest water project in the world, and has been for millennia. This thing is older than our calendar. It's mind-boggling, right? So I had these statistics memorized a couple of months ago, but the number of miles of freeway and high-speed rail that they've put in there is just dwarfs what's going on in the entire rest of the world. And this was a rare building that was actually being saved. Most of them are torn down and rebuilt, so they'll relocate the historical section into a different area. And I have to say that while traveling, especially in more remote areas or in smaller hamlets, I was often offered a seat, a cup of tea, even though I was being stared at. But there was great hospitality. It seemed like the less they had, the more they were willing to share it. It was really remarkable. I don't think that would happen here so much. If somebody came around who looked really different from us, we'd be like, go away, you know? What do you want? So it was the most foreign place I've ever been to that I felt safer in than I do here sometimes. So really an interesting set of experiences for me. This is another image that is not in the show, but it goes to that lack of separation between industry and residential areas and food growing, and it's all kind of jammed together. And it's it's really tough because it's not going to go well. You know, the numbers on environmentally induced illness are already through the roof, and these are official numbers sanctioned by the government, so it's probably worse than that. Yet everybody wants to get a leg up economically, so the main push is towards moderate prosperity for the masses. There are, of course, several at the top who make money hand over fist, and that gap is wider. That's probably one of the widest income gaps in the world. But it's a really tricky equation, because if they were to actually implement all of the environmental laws that they have on the books that are pretty serious, the cost of energy would go up, production would drop, wages would have to be cut back, dropped, people released from employment, moderate prosperity would be dipping back down, and then there would be hell to pay. So what do you do, right? You've got this enormous engine that you've been feeding and moving forward and stoking that fire, and it's like, how do you stop it? How do you change it, make it sustainable, and keep your population happy? Really, really, really tricky. It's like this is the biggest tightrope act I've ever seen, you know? That image is in the exhibition, but those of you who haven't seen it yet, there's lots to see. So this is a midnight fish market, live fish, fresh fish from surrounding lakes, and barged in on one side and trucked in from further lakes. And that's the trading floor in the middle. And so the fish gets scooped out with big nets from the tanks on the trucks, or walked across these planks in those big baskets and inspected in these little pools, and then they work out a price and it gets weighed and they pay, and then they go into other little vehicles with tanks, and the live fish ends up in the restaurant in the tank, so you can pick the one that, you know, you want to get them to fry up for you. Really big business. So by 6 a.m., everything's closed. Everything's gone. And I'd heard about this fish market, and we went there at 8 o'clock in the morning. It's like, well, I guess it's closed today. So the next day again, it's like, oh, it's still closed. How do they get their fish? And you know, worked it out finally. Oh, and by the way, one of the few places where there was something much more important and more interesting and you know, vital to them to pay attention to, rather than pay attention to me. So I was able to photograph quite freely, as long as I just kept out of the way of these, you know, 100 pounds of flopping fish whizzing past me. That was really the hardest thing, was to photograph without making a spectacle of myself. It was just almost impossible. And that was the shrimp end of the market, and it's dawn, and they're already starting to wrap it up. There were many places where I felt a little awkward about photographing, like I was somehow poaching on their lack of fortune, perhaps. But when we engaged with them, there was mostly the consensus was that, you know, they were just happy somebody came by and gave a damn. Like that somebody would notice or acknowledge in some way. And this is after work, on the stoop, waiting for dinner, just relaxing. But it's hard, you know. I mean, the air quality was just so tough. And these evaporation towers from coal-fired power plants, I mean, seriously, every 50 miles, pretty much. Back in here, there's an idyllic kind of natural scene, and there is, you know, there's great veneration for it, but the environmental load that they're carrying is really, really too high. This image was in my head for a long time because I wanted to establish that connection of how much things had changed. The trip on the canal from Beijing to Hangzhou used to take 2 months, and the train does it in 5.5 hours now. Problem was that the damn thing moved so fast I could never get, you know, establish the context. It was like, well, this is a picture of a train, and it's like it would just be this ghost, this blur. But there was a train station right next to this bridge where they were just starting to pick up speed, and so this was a good spot. These are sand digging boats. In Pizhou, so they're mining sand, and so it's construction material. It's just there's a pretty voracious appetite for it. So, and the canal really transports a lot of the high bulk, heavy, low value goods. You know, coal, sand, concrete, bricks. More desirable materials are, you know, usually trucked now, and only about half the canal is navigable for freight anymore. The upper, the northern part is lacking in water. So currently there's a project underway to turn a third of the water around and send it back north. And it's in full swing, they're already doing it. It's the water redirection project. I forget exactly what the name of it was. It was a pretty long name, but complicated tunnels and pumping stations and everything else to try to get the drought-stricken north some relief. Driving school. I've never seen a driving school this big, and this is on a slightly off day, so it wasn't really packed. But there were probably 15 of those tents. Maybe a few more extended further to the left and to the right. Each tent had one instructor, one car, and about 10 pupils. This is a big, big change, right? I mean, in a society that, how many of you have traveled to China in, say, 10 years ago or something like that? And what you saw on the street a lot was, you know, armies of bicycles, right, or mopeds, and it's all cars, and everybody wants a car, so there's a lot of pressure on this. Really dangerous work. Can't make a mistake there. This was on the outskirts of the city of Linqing, where all the bricks, it was the area where all the bricks for the Forbidden City were made. And this city paid its taxes to Beijing in the form of bricks. So the entire city, the Forbidden City, was built with this clay, with this material. And that's still one of the old traditional ovens, which is really only still working because they need them for restoration projects.
So how old are those?
Well, these, they keep, none of them are very old because they keep having to reconstruct them because they fall apart. They're just sort of mounded up and then they kind of deteriorate after so and so many firings and they have to sort of build them up again. But the method is, you know, centuries old. And the bricks get cooked. So this is on the inside of one of those kilns that's being loaded up, and there's a coal fire underneath that they'll then, you know, bake them and dry them out for weeks. This town was all about gravestones and stonework. Just incredibly industrious people everywhere I looked, you know. So gambling is illegal, but it's pervasive. It was really fun to watch how engaged they would get, you know. This was a satellite dish market, and everything else too. And so I want to end with this image, which encapsulates for me this tremendous change that has occurred there. There's the generation of the little emperors that they refer to as the single male child, raised in a middle class setting. And in the background is the statue of the Qing Emperor. And this was the dynasty that actually completed the canal all the way to Beijing, but at such high cost that there were 6 million people working on it at one point, and only 3 million made it. They died from hunger, exposure, and overworking, and which was then too much, and that caused a revolt, and the Qing dynasty ceased to be. But so these are the little emperors, and there's no sort of subservient posture there anymore. This is a totally different generation, right? And subjects no longer of that kind of regime, but a different regime. And what I initially read often as borderline hostility was really just curiosity at what I was doing and why. And so if I engaged and said hello, then they would come over and look at the camera and ask for another picture, and it was all fine, you know. So it was really an eye-opener that way. Not so much encountered in the big cities. In Beijing, I had just blended in like any other of 100,000 tourists that were there that day, you know, or Shanghai. But as soon as you got off the beaten track, this was pretty prevalent. So that's it on that. And this is the symbol of good luck.
Well, I'm sure that there are questions and comments in the room, so please raise your hand so that Philip can call on you. Way in the back there. Yes, please.
Hi. Yeah.
And I've heard some sources of information that sounds like it's from the United States media about environmental situations or our views of China. And I've heard you mentioned talking to some individuals. I presume there's a language barrier.
Yes.
Or how did you negotiate that? And then how many more conversations with people you're photographing did you have?
Okay. I'll see if I can answer all of those. But no, it's fine.
There's also, the point of view that you're bringing is that the misfortune of these people, and I wonder if they...
Well, that was an assumption on my part, right. And I was surprised, relieved to find that they didn't think of it that way. They were actually, their lot in life was improving, which was, I probably didn't explain that as well as I should have. But oftentimes it was... my misreading of their life at that moment, you know. And there is very much the outsider's view. I mean, one of the reasons I decided to work panoramically was because I didn't have a good handle on what I was looking at. So how was I going to pick something out and present it to you and make sense of it in some way, you know? So on the other hand, the outsider's view, after the last trip, which was 6 weeks, my guide, who was educated young man from Beijing, pretty fearless guy too, he was wonderful to work with, and that's how I was able to communicate, because he would engage and keep security guards at bay for a while if we were on some factory premises while I was working, and then I would join the conversation. But that's how I got a lot of this information, you know, about how the reaction to, oh, why are you photographing that old thing? Why would you do that? You know, those were just these snippets. Other places where I was told that I was the 20th foreigner that I'd seen in 20 years, 50 miles outside of Shanghai. So that told me a lot about the patterns that we travel when we're in China, the most of us, right? We're just Shanghai, Beijing, Xi'an, Terracotta Warriors, and maybe a couple of other places, unless you're doing business, in which case you are in these smaller towns, in the factory towns, probably being ferried around in a limo. So how much contact do you really have? And my desire for all of this stuff was to try to put a face on these statistics that we get deluged with, you know, on a daily basis. Statistics compiled from a Western perspective, no doubt, right? The thing about all of that data, that stream of data, this background noise at this point, it's like, oh, another report on China for us. It feels like it's all under control, right? Like we've got a handle on it. We know what's going on there. I don't think we know what's going on there, frankly. Most of us who actually benefit from Chinese labor and conditions that none of us in this room would accept to work under, yet we benefit from them doing this labor. They are benefiting by coming up, you know, getting an economic leg up. But at what cost? You know, that cost we all should be conscious of. We should all look at it. And probably the outsider is the one who might bring that back versus somebody on the inside. So what I was starting to say about my guide, he said at the end of the trip, he said, thank you for showing me China in a way I didn't know it. Even he in Beijing didn't know how it looked in between those, you know, those spots that he traveled. There was all this other stuff that he had no clue about. So I thought that was a good moment. You know, it gave me a sense of validation, because of course there's some trepidation on my part to go somewhere else and make photographs and bring them back and talk about them like I know what I'm talking about. I mean, I've been reading this stuff and kind of steeping myself in it as much as possible. But the outsider's view is also, I mean, Robert Frank was an outsider. He showed us America in a way that no American could see it. So it's, you know, I think it's an okay platform to use. Did I get all of your questions? Okay.
Okay, other questions or comments for Philip? Do raise your hand over here.
You have the floor.
Okay. What are the years that you traveled to China from?
2009 and 2010.
Okay, and then you said you had a 10-year full expedition of photography. Did you say 10 years?
Oh, I've got these sort of longer bodies of work, and they tend to span about 10 years.
Okay.
The night photography was about that long until it sort of ran its course. The landscape photography, which was I was hoping I would work my way through that in a couple of months so that I could go and do something relevant. That took 10 years. So, but I did finally get to a point where I thought I could use it in a way that was interesting. And without that work, I wouldn't have been able to do this work. You know, so.
Okay, over here.
Do you believe if you had maybe more time or more access to go into some of the places in the more wealthier, upscale areas, because the economic expansion, I'm sure, in the cities where, like you said, all these products are being made, and I'm guessing there's probably some marvelous methods they have of actually getting this stuff out and at a much more high-tech way. Do you think that you would ever, like I said, you had time, compare that, if you were able to gain access into those factories, compared to these, you know, much more urban areas where you can see that, I'm guessing there's two stories.
There's multiple stories.
Right.
I mean, you know, all of our Mac products, I think some of them are assembled here now, but most of them are assembled overseas in China. I'm sure those factories are run to, you know, in terms of technology at a very high level, because otherwise the products wouldn't fly over here. They wouldn't work. But we also know that there's great stress and labor difficulties, you know, because they feel pushed too much. And as the middle class rises there, they're also going to become more demanding, and they should, about working conditions, about environment, and everything else. There's so many threads to this story. So one of the things I've seen, I did crisscross the cities, both in Beijing and Shanghai, in more affluent areas and less affluent areas, and they looked surprisingly sort of westernized and very nicely appointed, like that convention center with that golden shimmering building, you know, that was a performing arts center and convention center and everything else, and it was top notch, you know. That's also happening. Many of the people who are part of this migrant labor force that work and live in factories and send money home and get to go home only a few times a year are not bemoaning their lot, because it's a hell of a lot better than what they had when they were out in the sticks and couldn't rub two nickels together. So, you know, our demand for goods drives that transformation that country is undergoing right now. Our, as in the entire first world, rich countries that can afford to import all of this stuff. So it all ties back to us. But at the same time, I think we should know what the cost is.
Well, Philip,
I don't have a solution for it, but I think we should have the discussion that might lead us to some better solutions, because not everything that you see here is good. You wouldn't want to live that way, right? Or work that way. So how is that okay? But I'm also buying Chinese products every day. So it's a tricky thing, right? It's like I can't point there without pointing at me. And I'm not trying to point over there. I'm just saying there's a lot of us who are blissfully ignorant of what is actually happening there and what it actually looks like on the ground. We'd rather not know. It's too uncomfortable. And I think we have to know. So that's kind of what drove me to do this.
Now, Philip, I'm going to quote you from earlier and then also just throw in a quick statistic. Hundreds of miners are killed every month in China in coal mining. Hundreds upon hundreds of miners are killed. They get killed in scores at a time in terms of mine disasters and everything else. So I think that behind what you're saying is that behind the miracle and behind our consumption are some really hard lingering questions. But the one that you raised, and I'd love to have you comment on more, and I saw other hands, is that there were a lot of us who did work like this. We worked like this 100 years ago.
Right.
Right. So what you're saying is that there's kind of the rise of modernity and everything else. But the issue is that there are so many Chinese. If every one of them had an automobile, I think really what you're saying, we would end up destroying the world. So the question is that you really raised is, can we, in effect, allow China to go down a certain developmental path?
Well, and that's sticky, right? Like, who are we to allow or disallow? I mean, but we have to have this conversation.
To acquire the products.
But then they hold so much of our debt, right? So, I mean, we are so in bed with everybody else. We just have to look at this and be sober about it and figure out a way ahead. Hopefully use some sound science to base our decisions on how we move forward so that we don't, you know, lose our atmosphere.
Now, Mark, and then I've seen some other hands.
I'm curious, have you ever considered using the diptych in this context to heighten some of the visual contradictions you're talking about?
I think that's a good idea. I think that's a valid point. I'm sort of a one trick at a time pony, and so once I get into something, that's all I can do. There were photographs that I took with a slightly longer lens that I pieced together. There was no reason to do it. I could have just taken one shot, but I'm just so into it, you know. So valid question, you know, not a very good answer. Sorry.
Okay, I saw other hands over here. Kathy?
years. Mm-hmm. So when I look at this right now, I'm seeing...
Oh, there's no seams or anything, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. To his point, this would have been just fine as a single capture. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't thinking straight. So these guys are right there in one shot. There's another shot here, and there's two more over here. But I really could have just used a slightly wider lens and shot it all in one go. And it would have just been one moment, and it wouldn't have been substantially different than what you see here, which is assembled out of multiple moments. So this is wider than I can see. This is wider than any lens I have. And if at that point I were to take one capture and blow it up to 4 feet, it would just be mush. So there I do need to have just the sheer real estate. And this is one of the fewest, this is one of the images with the fewest number of images in it. And they're just three horizontals, you know, together. These guys were pretty stable. But this guy right here, it's that guy. So he just showed up over here now, because I was trying to do this quickly to keep everything else sort of pretty stable, and you know, it happens sometimes.
So that took 3 seconds.
Just three, right.
Or
yeah, I mean, I was hand-holding, it's, you know, cranked up
so
the
you
sensitivity.
Had another type of?
No, it just, I was getting run over by fish, I mean, you know, so it was, I was trying to just stay out of their way. This is much longer time and on the tripod and over and under exposing. So this is the one that came out at 45 gigs after I finished stitching it. You know, it's just an enormous file. But here there were, you know, the truck was there, the truck was gone, the red truck moved. There were all these things shifting, these people moved around. So that was something that I just kind of worked on for a while. Well, you can, and it collapses everything into one photograph when it's done. I have all these layers that I can decide to include or to exclude. And sometimes I have 4 layers deep right here, because this guy keeps coming closer and I like him right there. So I can pick, right? I don't know that I have something that I could call up quickly enough to show you the sort of the bones of how this goes together, but I think most of you would probably fall asleep. It's a lot of work after the fact, that's for sure.
Okay, we have a question yeah. here and then in back.
For others who are interested in, you know, child photography and also even like the journalistic aspect, do you have any suggestions or advice for, you know, dealing with that outside perspective while also trying to get, you know, a really true image without also insulting the culture and people that are in that image?
Read voraciously, find out as much as you can, talk to people who've been there, who've lived there as much as possible. I mean, really, you know, information is your friend. And then sometimes you'll offend somebody inadvertently because you just behave wrong. And for that culture, that's bound to happen, but your posture as you travel in a foreign place should be one of, you know, humility, not of brashness, of being loud, of like, well, I know what I'm doing, so, you know, get out of my way. It doesn't go over so well. And if you're a traveler, you already instinctively know this. The curious thing for me was that I was traveling in a place where there was no way in hell I could blend in. So that was just, okay, I'm here, you know. You can stare at me all you like. It's fine. Yeah.
Okay. I think I had another question back here.
Yeah, I was trying to get a sense more of the technical process that you're talking about. What goes into your decisions about what you include and exclude? I mean, is it a visual decision?
It's visual, and it's remembering being there and what transpired. And I'm, now that I don't have to pick that 125th of a second, now I can say, well, these 10 minutes were pretty good. You know, I was there for a longer time. I remember more of it, and I'll include that stuff that supports that memory. I mean, memory is a funny thing, you know. We change it all the time. If all of us here witnessed an accident from 50 different positions, we'd have 50 different stories. The only thing we could all agree on is that there was an accident. But who's at fault, how it happened, what happened first, the color of the other car. I mean, all of that stuff is like, you know, all bets are off. So it's a completely personal picture. And getting back to your point about making, you know, a true image, this is true to what I remember and what I thought was important and interesting, and this is my story to tell, right? Any photograph is someone's story to tell. There is no such thing as an objective camera. Even a traffic camera is not an objective thing, because it's set up for a purpose, to nail you when you speed through that intersection, right? There's nothing objective about any of it, or random, or without intent. There's intent behind all images. And something I said earlier today, and if you were there, I apologize for repeating myself, but if you are a press photographer and you are adhering to the code of uncropped image, unmanipulated, true, pure, whatever loaded word you want to use, okay? And there's some candidate behind a microphone and you're photographing them. You don't even have to look. You could just hold your finger down on that shutter button and fire off 200 shots in 10 seconds. A minute, whatever. And then you go and pick the image that you're going to run, depending on the story you want to tell, right? It's going to be a subjective choice, or your editor's subjective choice. So none of this stuff holds water in my book, that the uncropped, unadulterated, pure image is somehow more, has more veracity or truth in it or purity to it. That it's someone's story. So to me, what's important is to make sure that you disclose your method of working, who's paying you, and why you're doing it. And then tell your story. Then no conflict, right? But when you have somebody like a scientist who's been paid by fossil fuel industry to constantly bugger up statistics from the other side, you know, he's sort of on the climate denier side, but saying it's pure science, and I think this is, and then you see where the money was, then, you know, you smell a big fat rat, and that's as it should be.
I'm going to have Shirley have the last question or comment, then I would love to have all of you join us, if possible, down in the gallery, because Howard is here, Shirley is here, and Philip is here. And if you're interested in getting up close and personal with the man in the cormorant boat, among other
quarter
things,
inch.
Yeah,
that the glass.
Really close to the plexiglass. So, Shirley.
Well, this was all fascinating, and the one question I have is kind of based on my own research on photography in the Second Industrial Revolution in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Who had the camera?
Who'd what?
Right. When I think about Thomas Bell's Out of His Furnace, who has a camera? It's not the worker. It's somebody who wants to make social change. It's somebody who wants to,
yes,
you know, lighten up. So my question to you is, did you need anybody else with a camera in your...
Thousands of people, but not where I was going.
Exactly.
You know, it was...
The worrisome thing for me is I see these workers who have no access to create their own history, and as all this disappears, that disappears as well. And
mm-hmm.
We get a different type of history of, again, the winners, the wealthy, the one percenters, put it however you want to call them. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ones who get to rewrite the history, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So thank you.
So okay. Let us please give Philip Ritterman another round of applause.
Thanks. And thank you all for coming out. This was really a very cold night. I think it was extremely cold coming from California, so thank you for braving the cold.
Do come back for our March brown bags. Do sign in, and if you have a chance, please come down with us into the gallery so that you can see some of the photographs down there. Thanks so much for coming.